Okay, good afternoon. Today we're going to look at more synchronization with barriers, or that go beyond barriers in particular. So we're going to look at locks, which you probably have heard about, or we'll just try to get a low-level look at locks, which hopefully is new. Okay, so last time we spoke about memory barriers and where to put them in order to recreate the sequential consistency in a program or the program semantics. And today I want to talk a bit about locks and all the constructions that lead up to locks. So locks are usually what you use at the lowest level in everyday programming, and above locks there are monitors, and I'll touch upon those as well. So why do we need more expressive constructs at all? So memory barriers have very specific uses. So it's about coordinating state transitions between different threads, and that can, as I said last time, could be like that several threads are implementing a finite automaton and that they kind of synchronize each other. And if you are programming an operating system, then you do not have access to anything that suspends you and that blocks you for a certain while. So you just need to synchronize directly with somebody else. So busy waiting is the only option you have anyway, because there's no operating system. But even then, if you do have an operating system, then you might still want to use the barriers because of the small overhead and the if you're sure that you don't really need. Don't ever actually want to be descheduled, because what you're doing is very brief and short. Okay, so a very common concept where barriers are eventually not really the right thing to use is when a certain part or certain pieces of memory have to be modified at once by one thread. And although you can like implement an automata with barriers, it's usually better to use some other mechanism. And because this is a very common usage, that two threads need to be hold a certain set of resources at once, and they require mutually exclusive access to these resources. So since this is a reoccurring concept that you need to protect a set of resources while you modify them, we will have special constructs for that. So to draw happens before diagrams for these situations, you have several resources, for instance A and B, and you need to update these at once or seemingly at once. So you require some sort of atomic execution to set A to 1 and B to 1, and you want this to happen at once from the point of view of other threads. So this is difficult with barriers, because as soon as you have several values, you need to somehow implement something like DECA, which is basically an algorithm to create a mutual exclusion, and usually you don't want simply to set something to constants, but you want certain information from the thread to flow into this computation, and you might want to extract certain information. So some information flows from this computation that should be atomic to the thread. So in general, we could talk about a concept called atomic executions as a building block for concurrent programs. So if assuming that a concurrent program consists of several threads, they will share some common resources, otherwise they don't need to communicate, and the whole concurrent programming is rather trivial. So these resources are often and usually pieces of memory, but it could be an I/O entity, like a port or something, or for instance even a file handle. It could be that you open a file at one place and then you update this pieces of this file in several threads, and maybe one thread wants to modify a certain area and another thread is modifying a different area, and by using the standard Unix API where the current file pointer has a notion of position in the file, you need to make sure that you set the file pointer to the right position, do your modifications all at once, and then before the other thread has a chance to set the file pointer to a different position and do the modifications. So you protect this act of setting the file pointer and doing the writes or reads by a mutual exclusion, by a region that's protected by a mutual access mutually exclusive from the other region. Okay, so as I said, like maybe you need to like set a file pointer and do something like reading and writing. So often there is some sort of invariant on these resources that must be retained. So for the file example, you need that the file pointer resides at the position you set it to and it's not modified by another thread while you're reading and writing it. And if you think of a linked list, for instance, then the head and the tail pointer must have certain invariants, namely that if you go to the head and you dereference by the next field, you eventually come to the node that's pointed to by the tail pointer. However, during an update of such a linked list, then this invariant is temporarily broken because in order to, for instance, insert a node into the beginning of the list, you need to make the head pointer point to the new element. In that situation, this new element isn't pointing already to the head of the list, so this invariant that the head pointer points to a linked list is broken. Maybe there's a way to program this that the invariant is never broken. So, for instance, you could say, okay, so first, so we have this linked list, and the next pointer, so the next pointer resides here, and I just draw it like this to say that the next pointer is pointing to this cell. So, and then we have a head pointer somewhere, and it points to the head of the list, and a tail pointer, like this. So in order to add a new element like this, the list invariant says, well, my head pointer has to point to a node, and then by going to the next field, eventually I'll find the tail of the node, and I don't go in circles. It will terminate. So in order to add a new node, I could, as I said, I could let the head pointer point to this new node, but then the problem is the list invariant is broken. So what I could do instead is I could make this pointer first point to the head of the list, and then in the second step change the head pointer to point to the new node. And in principle, this will retain the invariant of the linked list. However, if a second process comes along and does the same action, so it also creates a cell and makes this pointer to point to the head of this linked list, and then later change this head pointer, then the invariant isn't broken because the head pointer still points to a valid linked list, but it might not be the semantics that you intended, because you want that if you insert a list to the element to the list, that it's actually in the also in the list. So that's another part of the invariant that's broken here. So an invariant might be complex, might be very difficult to actually understand all the implications of an invariant, which makes parallel programming or concurrent programming so hard, because you need to understand what is the invariant that I need to protect. Okay, and in particular, an invariant usually spends several resources. So a head and a tail pointer, and the fact that if you add a cell, it should be afterwards be inside the cell so you don't leak anything. And that requires that you update several resources at once in order to ensure that the invariant still holds. So, as I've demonstrated already, what constitutes these resources that you need to update together depends... sometimes depends on the current program state. So if the list is empty, it might be in a list that where head and tail pointer point to the same sentinel node, and that might require a different algorithm or different branch inside the algorithm. So if we want to specify a change of a piece of an algorithm that has to execute at one unit in order to break the invariant locally, reestablish the invariant, and so that globally the invariant always seems to be holding. What we really want as a building block is something that marks the sequence of statements as an atomic operation. And in that case, if we do that, then and we wrap all the, say, an insertion of a linked list element by an atomic execution, then this invariant that should hold on a data structure will never be broken, from the outside at least. Okay, so it's all about doing some sort of atomic execution. Okay, so what I'll do is today is I'll just talk about how to implement these atomic operations. So that will bring us to lock-free, weight-free locking and monitors. So that will I'll do all that today. And next week I'll talk a little bit about deadlocks, and then we go on beyond that to transactional memory, where this idea is generalized. But for today, I will just show you the established ways of managing synchronization, and these are the techniques that are available on most platforms nowadays. And this is what you'll come across if you look at current concurrent software written in C or Java. They provide solutions to solve the commonly occurring tasks like ensuring mutual exclusion. And these techniques are also the source of common concurrency problems. So beyond not being able to identify what the invariant is that my data structure should obey, you might also introduce other problems like starvation and deadlock. Okay, so all these things that I talk about are present in C++, and in Java and C#. The monitors at least are there. Okay, so what I want you to take away is not there are locks and you can use them and this is how you do it. I think you've done that already. So I'd like to give you a higher level view that what you need is to execute as some sort of atomic execution. Like you need some sort of atomic execution to execute a set of statements as one block, so that its internals of this set of sequences is not visible to the outside. So it's you should think of concurrent programming as atomic executions of certain critical paths that access common shared resources. And then I'll talk about weight-free algorithms, and so this is like one step above barriers. And using barriers, and then I'll talk about locks and their implementation. And with locks come mutexes, which are just like specific uses of locks, semaphores, and monitors. And next week I'll talk about deadlocks and how to, say, statically analyze a program that it doesn't contain deadlocks. Okay, so back to atomic executions. There are several varieties we could have. We could define for atomic executions. So, first, the definition: a computation forms an atomic execution if its effect can only be observed as a single transformation on the memory. So, observe means by other threads, because I myself, obviously, I'm executing the individual statements, and I'm observing the semantics that the statements have. So, this is talking about the other processes or the other threads. So there are several classes of atomic executions. For instance, you could have a weight-free atomic execution that always succeeds and never blocks. So there's two aspects to atomic executions that we can actually implement in actual hardware. So an atomic execution may not succeed, it might fail to succeed, or it might block, meaning that it has to wait for other threads to proceed in whatever they're doing before it can actually start the atomic execution. So the wait-free algorithms are those that we really strive for because they always succeed and they never block, which is very good. And then there are lock-free algorithms. These may fail, but they never block. So that means failing means that the operation that was supposed to be executed has not been done and nothing has been changed. So it's not a failure in the sense that something went wrong. It's just a failure that it couldn't be completed, the operation. And then we have locks. So these atomic executions are called locked. So this atomic execution, it always succeeds, but it may block the thread. So if you know locks, then you know that, like, you try to take a lock before you enter a critical section and then you release the lock. So if you manage to take the lock, then you have full access to all the shared resources. You can do whatever you need to do, and then you can release it. So you will never fail executing your sequence of statements inside once you obtain the lock. But if you're unable to obtain the lock, the operating system may block you, or you just have to wait. So you're blocked in whatever you want to do. And the fourth kind to implement an atomic execution is a transaction. So this transaction may fail in contrast to lock, but then it might give you some sort of recovery mechanism so that it actually in practice it looks like it will succeed eventually and you don't have to worry about locking.
Here's a question.
Oh, well, then please ask. Lock-free. Lock-free are like transactions, but the thing is, in practice, they differ in the amount of data, expressivity, and granularity. So, and that it makes a practical impact. So the amount of data is very small for whatever you'd want to do with lock-free algorithms, whereas in transactions, it's larger. And in principle, it has to be arbitrarily large, otherwise there are certain algorithms you can't implement. And there's also the question of expressivity. So lock-free algorithms have expressivity means what kind of operations, what kind of statements can I write. And with lock-free algorithms, you're limited to very, very basic and fixed operations. And granularity refers to the how many memory cells you can modify. And I'll give some examples. So transactions, this refers to software transactional memory or hardware transactional memory, and this will be subject of the last lectures. Okay, so I'm going to start with wait-free and lock-free algorithms. So first of all, wait-free. So the question is, here we have some operations, and my question is, which of these operations are executed atomically on a modern CPU? So I have three programs, one that takes an integer, so here I say J and temp are somehow in registers, so I don't really care, but I is the variable that actually resides in memory, so that is visible to the other threads. So which of these operations can I execute atomically so that the other CPU doesn't just sees the state before and afterwards, but nothing in between? Or is there any program here that where you think this is not atomic? So assume these are C programs as they're written, and you want to execute them. And I'm asking you, can I see anything else? Like if I is 4 in the first program, am I able to create some sort of interference so that if I is 4 before, it will not be 5 afterwards, for instance? I'm not asking you. Anybody?
Yeah, the first one is for sure not atomic, because the first you have to fetch I and then increment it and after that store it again, and it can be interrupted anywhere between these steps.
Okay. So can you give me a sequence? So I'm reading I. So let's say square parenthesis means I'm accessing the address of I, where I resides. So I'm just writing like this. So I resides in memory, and I'm reading this into a register. Then I say the register is equal to the register. Well, let's make an arrow. Plus one. And then I'm writing at the address of I the new value of R. So these three instructions is the implementation of I++. So what can another thread do to disrupt this? So if I is, let's assume that at the beginning of the program, well, we should assume our usual assumption. So at the beginning of the program, I 0. And then the question is, what can the other thread in blue here do to disrupt this, to make the result here so that I is not 1?
Between the second and third step, you can change R.
Okay. What value should I change I to so that it... So the thing is, so the question is again, what is the automaticity here and what is the assumption? So let's assume this other program also does I++, just to make it give you half the solution. Because the thing is, if I just say, well, we set I to 1, then I will never be able to tell the difference. There's nothing broken, because if I execute the left program, then the right program... or the right program and the left program, and in both cases I will be, it will be 1 in the first sequence, and if I execute the right program and then the left program, I will get 2, because first I set I to 1 and then I increment it.
Well, it could happen that the first one sets its R to, one, to the value 1, but it hasn't written it back. The second one has already fetched the value of 1, then the first one writes back...
Wait. So I'm writing values in green. So this is 0.
Yes.
So this will be 1. And so here I'm reading an I.
Exactly.
What is I?
2. The value from I is still 0.
Mm-hmm.
Then it performs the R plus 1. So it gets 1.
Yep.
So the value is 1 in R.
Yes. Oh, not so fast. Okay.
Then the first ones, the red one stores its value for R.
Mm-hmm, which is 1.
Which is 1. And the second one overrides it with the value of 1.
Yeah. Okay, so if I execute I++ in one thread and I++ in a different thread, I need to observe 2 at the end. And so in this case here, what we've now constructed, I will be 1 at the end and not 2. So this is not what we expect.
But on Intel it depends, right? Because there is a increment instruction with a memory operand, which can also...
It's not atomic.
May also get a lock prefix on.
Well, that's different. That's what's on this slide. So if I++ isn't necessarily atomic... then all these other statements are surely not atomic because they're even more complex. So the answer is none of these program fragments are atomic by default, not even without store and invalidate buffers. And the reason is, we've just gave the reason because we could, if we break them down into individual statements, they could be interleaved in such a way that the result is not what the sequential execution of I++ here and I++, say, on another thread would yield. However, all of these operations can be atomic. So let's look at the other operations. So what does this do? So this reads a value of I, and it increments I by a certain constant and then writes it back to I. So this is a bit generalization of I++. Basically, get the old value of I and we increment I by a constant. And the third operation... there's a temporary, and we read I, and we write a different value J to I, and then we write the temp to J. So this basically swaps the contents of two memory addresses. Well, or here one is a register. Well, we're swapping the value of a register with a value in main memory. Okay, so all of these programs can be atomic on processes like Intel and ARM and PowerPC. So we assume that I is a memory, otherwise this is all pointless. And we could, well, in C we could achieve that by declaring it as volatile, so that it's every time we read the value, the compiler will actually read it from memory. And then, but we cannot really write this down in C, so this is a bit mode. So most CPUs can lock the cache for the duration of an instruction, meaning that they could say, well, make sure that this I is in exclusive state in my local cache, perform this operation to completion, and only then allow any invalidate or read invalidate request to be processed. So on Intel, for instance, you can have this famous lock prefix, and then an increment statement that just takes the address of I as an argument. And in this case, the processor will load the value of I into the cache, apply the increment operation, so then put the cache line in exclusive state, and disallow anybody else to invalidate the cache line, it performs the increment, and after that, other processors can invalidate the cache line or do a read request, or read invalidate, rather. And the second program, what this does is it fetches the current value of I and then increments I. So K, the constant that we want to increment I by 1, is moved to the register EAX, and then we execute this cross-add operation that takes an address I with this lock prefix. So it reads I, it stores the value of I in EAX, and before that it remembers the value of EAX, and that's what's stored at the address of I. So this is like, again, it adds the value in EAX to the value that's currently at the address of I and stores it at the same address. And at the same time, it takes the previous value at that address and stores it in EAX. So it's a swap with an addition on the side. And afterwards, the previous value of I is in EAX, and then we move that to the register in which J is stored. So this implements the second program. And the third program that just swaps is implemented by the exchange operation, and it also needs this lock prefix, otherwise it's not atomic, and the address of I in the register, and it just swaps the contents of the two atomically. So there's no way that anybody else can read or write, usually write a different value while I'm reading it and writing the value into the cache line. Okay, so without lock, as we've worked out, the load and the store operations generated by I++, for instance, could be interleaved with this same operation from another processor giving unexpected results. Okay, so when can we use these very basic operations that can be atomic? So one common usage in garbage collectors, for instance, is a weight-free algorithm to do so-called bumper pointer allocation. So in every Java virtual machine, this will be used at some point. So suppose we have a heap, which is just a large blob of bytes, and a free pointer that points to the very first byte of this array. So this is the array. It has indices 0 to the power of 20 minus 1. And then my free pointer, first free, it points up here to the very first element. And the idea is of bumper pointer allocation, whenever some thread needs memory, it will just add the amount of memory it needs to the first free and remember the previous value of first free. So if I allocate 20 bytes, then I will make this pointer point to 20, and I will return 0, because that's the beginning of my of the new object that I've just allocated. So this is implemented in this code. So the return value start of my new object that is of size is the address of the first free pointer. Then I'm adding size to the first free pointer, and then afterwards I have to check if the pointer that I got plus the size, so which is the first free value, is greater than the size of the heap, then I need to garbage collect, which is like handled very abstractly here by calling something. And then I return start as the start address of the new object that I've just allocated. Okay. So if I want to have a thread safe implementation so that several mutators can actually allocate objects concurrently, then I could just implement this with this cross at operation where I say log x at first free address of the first free pointer that's shared amongst all the threads, EAX, which contains the size. And afterwards, EAX will contain the value of the first free pointer, which is the beginning of my new object, and first free will be incremented by the value, previous value in EAX, which was the size. So in order to write this in C, I need inline assembler, so that's a bit inconvenient. But there are actually some... on every operating system, there is a. It usually has a some sort of built-in library for each platform where you have these atomic operations as some inline macro. And there's a library by Hans Böhm from HP, which tries to implement this across platforms. Okay. So I don't want to write assembler, and I don't want to write some made-up functions that only exist in, say, Linux. So what I do is I create a new keyword, which doesn't exist, so please don't try this at home. So this keyword is called atomic, and then I simply put a normal basic block behind this atomic keyword in curly parentheses. So I'm just writing atomic i++, and then I'll get the instruction that does the i++, including the lock. Same thing here and here. So these are my atomic versions of the three programs that I had earlier. So in terms of the happen before notation, I can just simply write this as a single statement. So I take this whole program here and write it as one atomic execution, which means it has a beginning. It accesses the shared resource in which is I here, the value that's the address that's shared amongst several threads. So there could be a B thread trying to access this with the same atomic expression. So here we have a different atomic expression. And then this atomic expression will either happen before and finish before this other atomic expression, or it will happen afterwards, but not... so they can't mix. They have to be before or after each other. So the problem is I can only write atomic... if the corresponding atomic CPU instruction exists. So there's a very clear limit as to what I can write. However, this notion or this idea of just writing atomic around a sequence of statements is a very general one, because this basically encapsulates me wanting to implement a certain algorithm that will temporarily break an invariant and reestablish the invariant before relinquishing access to the shared resources. So when you have, if in case you've ever already used locks and you have a lock and unlock around your code, you could just write atomic around it and just say, oh, the compiler should do this for me. So in future, I will just use atomic, the atomic keyword with the basic block to say, oh, this should be executed atomic, and I'll talk about how to implement it. Okay, so we've seen wait-free algorithms, like very tiny algorithms, and they're cool because they will never block, they will always succeed. However, they're limited to what a CPU can execute on as a single instruction. There's usually no control flow, except that sometimes the behavior of these single instructions could depend on data. So in this case, they kind of implement a little bit of control flow, but really there's certainly nothing we can write as control flow because it has to be a single instruction. Many architectures that feature threads, they feature some sort of atomic operation that executes something conditionally. So this is a little bit of control flow. So here are more programs. So the first one reads the value of a variable b and then sets b to 0. The second the fifth program does the same but sets b to 1. And the third operation, it does actually something conditional. It first checks to see, so the I is the memory region again, and K and R are registers. So R, K, are registers. So they're not shared resources. So first, here we compare the value of I with some constant, K, stored in K, and if and store the result in R. If these are the same, then I'm assigning something to I, I write something to I, so J is also a register. Otherwise, I don't. So these operations, so the first two programs, they kind of update a memory cell and return the previous value. And, well, we kind of seen that something similar on the previous slide. So here the first two operations, they kind of set a flag, B, to a value 0 or 1. And you could say, well, if I'm setting B to 0 and it already contains 0, then it doesn't do anything. So if B doesn't already contain V, then only then this setting is done. So you could say, oh, it's a bit conditional, but really it's just writing 0. And these instructions are called modify and test. So testing basically means you want the previous value. So this is a little bit like this cross add. And the second one is a generalization of this to arbitrary values, and then this operation is called compare and swap. So you compare two values, like one in memory and one that you have locally, and if they're the same, you're writing something else. And you could say you swap it because you know what you're comparing to. So you kind of could say it's swapping. And these algorithms are interesting, or these three concepts, they are interesting as building blocks for larger algorithms because by checking whether something has a certain value, you can build algorithms that sometimes fail because a value is not as expected. So this brings us to lock-free algorithms. So lock-free algorithms don't use locks, they don't block. They basically try to update something, but they might sometimes find out that they can't. So in case a wait-free implementation is not possible because our processor lacks the instruction that implements this complex algorithm, we can still try to implement a lock-free implementation. So, for instance, this compare and swap notion where you compare two values and only if they're equal you exchange them can be used to construct a lock-free algorithm as follows. So, so I contains the shared resource and you load I into K, a local register, and you could need memory barriers to ensure that you're really reading something that's up to date. Okay, then you have a local version, like a copy of an I that was valid at some point in K, and then you compute whatever you need to compute on K. So this is like computing the new value of I, which is called J, and on J this invariant that you want on I holds. And then you update this I to the value of J if I is still hasn't changed. So we have the previous value of I, which is K. So we compare I to K, and if I is still the same, then we assume that nobody else has accessed or updated I in between, and then we set I to the new value J and we do this atomically with this compare and swap operation. Now, it can now be the case that I has changed, in which case this compare and swap operation comes back and it says, well, the result is I couldn't swap it because the values weren't the same. And in this case, I have to go to the first step and read the new updated version of I into K and do the whole thing again. So this is like an infinite loop trying to get some value, update it, and store it again. Now this already has some problems because if I compare I with K in this step, in this atomic compare and swap, it must really mean that the other thread has not updated the value. So if the other thread, say you're counting occurrences of some event and the other thread has updated I, which is a character, only 256 times, then you'll see the same value, but assuming that nothing has happened during that time is wrong because it has happened 256 times, so you can't see the effect anymore. Okay, so this algorithm here is a general recipe for log-free algorithms. So if you have a compare and swap operation for n bytes, you try to group the variables for which the invariant must hold into these n bytes, and then you can read these bytes atomically, hopefully somehow. I mean, usually it's 8 bytes, and then you can read them all at once on a 64-bit machine, calculate the new value, and then you do a compare and swap operation on these n bytes. Now, the problem is if your function f has certain side effects, then this algorithm doesn't work because you need to compute f several times. So this is a second caveat. So the computing the value has to be repeatable. Okay, so this looks rather weak, maybe, because you're limited to n bytes. But you could also, so for instance, if you were a programmer in Java, you had primitives for this in Java, then obviously most things that you compute in Java are objects, and an object is just a pointer. So what you could do is you could take the old object pointer, compute something new, create a new object, and then try to store this new pointer into I. So you only need 4 bytes or 8 bytes to represent the pointer. And this works very well unless there's a garbage collection cycle in between and the other thread updates. Let's assume I contains the address 200. Then you read that 200 address, read the object, compute a new object at address 400. And meanwhile, a different thread comes along, does the same thing, and you're computing a long time on this object before you try to write it back. And then there's a garbage collection cycle, and this new... that's not so easy. So in general, if you have a garbage collection, if you create a new object, you usually can assume that this object lives at a new address. But if there's a garbage collection happening, and here this other object lies at 300, now we have garbage collection, then these objects might be shuffled around, and so this 300 object is really moved to the address 200, and this stays gets to the address 100. Then this does a compare and swap and sees, oh, I'm still looking at address 200, so this object hasn't changed. So in the common resource, the address is still 200 and the object hasn't changed. But I'm reading actually the address of the newly allocated object. And then I do the compare and swap, assuming that the other thread hasn't no other thread has done anything. And now Julian is going to tell me that this can't happen.
Now the 300 is created, then the 200 is collected, and then again another third creates an object at address 200.
Well, my example is a bit fake because the object at 200 cannot be collected because it's still live, it's still sitting in the variable.
It can be dead, because now
really?
When creating the 300, the 200 becomes
No. But the other thread hasn't written anything back. So the 200 still. So this is like a memory cell in some object that holds the previous value, and the previous value isn't dead yet. It won't be dead until one of the threads overrides it. So, I mean, for garbage collected environments, it's actually very safe. It's unlikely to fail. But in principle, the danger is that garbage collector could come along and, in principle, shift your addresses around. There might be an example with several threads where this actually works better. But at the moment, I don't see how you can actually break it with a garbage collector.
Okay, and is there... can you create data structures that are not incorrect with this technique?
That are not incorrect? I hope so.
This looks like you can't do anything really interesting, because if you can't even do it with pointers, what can you do with them? I mean, if you...
Well, but I mean, like in C you can do it, because you know that you're in charge of freeing memory. That's very safe in C to do. So here the third unknown that might break your invariant is the garbage collector, and you don't have that in C. And in C, if you call malloc, you will get a fresh address. And if you say this has to be a mallocked address all the time and not a freed one, then it's clear that that this object hasn't changed. Yes.
From a list, you could remove an element, then do something nasty, and then again enter it, which could result in...
Yes, you can't do that. You always need to put in a new address. So, yeah, it's not so easy, but it's doable. And in the garbage collected environment, it might be even easier. Who knows? But there's the garbage collector. So, all right, so there are certain limitations of weight and log-free algorithms. For weight-free algorithms, we've seen we need to be able to express our algorithm with the instructions that can be executed atomically. With the log-free algorithms, we need to be able to express our invariant as n bytes, where n is usually 4 or 8, depending on the processor, which could be a pointer, but even with pointers, we might have problems eventually.
Mm-hmm. That their operations are atomic, there are some, and run on devices that don't, on processors that don't support any atomic commands or so. How do they work?
Usually any processor that can work in a multiprocessor environment will have some sort of atomic instructions. But even if you have a processor that just features interrupts, where the current execution is interrupted by a hardware event, then you need to do some sort of communication, and usually you can implement the logs by disabling interrupts in the main routine. Then you show no interrupt is kind of interrupting your critical section. That's one way, and there's also if you have very simple architectures where you have, say, a register that's globally visible, and all the other interrupts use that register as well. You can use the upper bit of this register to store a flag, and then you can atomically modify this flag by adding 10000 to this. You can set it, and you can see in the carry flag the previous value. So there's weird tricks. But in general, I would say anything that any processor that you can create a multi-core system from will have some atomic operations like fetch and add, like Spark, ARM. What was the other one? The other RISC. Well, they're all dead. MIPS, but there's also the other one with A. Alpha, yeah. They're kind of in Power, but Power is newer. So Alpha was one of the pioneering architectures with this. They did a lot of these concurrency constructs and the atomic instructions. Okay, so fetch and add can bring us a long way, but if we just consider our invariance has to span 8 bytes, then it can not might not be enough in practice. Or if we can't allocate memory, for instance, or we can't just ensure that each time that if we can simply cannot express that our invariant is different just by storing it in 8 bytes or 4 bytes, then we're stuck eventually. Okay, and on top of this, all these atomic operations, they're very architecture specific. So if you write something on one architecture, then we might be unable to implement it on a different architecture. But usually what we have is we have some sort of exchange of a memory cell with a register. And the generalization of this is usually also common, which is a compare and swap. So you first compare that it's equal, and if it's equal, you swap. Otherwise, you don't do it, and you know that you haven't done anything. Another common instruction is fetch and add, this cross add, xadd, and the modify and test, which is very similar, which is the stripped down version, really, of fetch and add, of compare and swap. Sorry. So these instructions usually only allow one memory operand for the simple reason that the CPU then only has to ensure that the cache line of one address is in the cache and is not modified or touched while the operation is executed. So we can only implement very simple algorithms with these. For instance, what we can implement are binary semaphores. So a binary semaphore is a flag, so it's 0 or 1. And if it's set, the semaphore is called acquired. If it's not set, if it's 0, it's called free. So we can acquire it by setting it if it's not set, and we can free it by unsetting it. And we can implement the generalization, which are counting semaphores. So this would be the modify and test operations. And the generalization is a counting semaphore, which is an integer that that can be decreased if it's non-zero, and we can increase it. And this is this fetch and add operation, or can be implemented with fetch and add operation.
But we can also implement the counting semaphore using the binary semaphore, right?
No, the other way around. I can implement the binary semaphore using the counting semaphore.
But also the other way around, because we can have a binary semaphore only lets one process in, right?
Well, it's 0 or 1, the value of the variable.
So you can have a particular section that only allows one process. And this can then, in the critical section, you can do things.
Well, okay, so you can always create. Okay, so I'm not talking about critical sections yet, but a semaphore is a general concept. You could also just stop and start a process or something.
But implemented by hardware, that way, without doing it.
Yes, so I'm talking about, well, what can I build from lock-free data structures and weight-free data structures? And these are semaphores, binary, and counting. And I can obviously implement a binary semaphore with a counting semaphore. The other way around, I can implement anything using a binary semaphore if I use it as a lock. Okay. But I'll come to that. So if I'm using a binary semaphore for protecting a critical section to ensure that I have mutual exclusion in a critical section, that's called a mutex. From mutual exclusion. So mutex is a data structure that lets you protect a sequence of instructions. And the generalization of the mutex, again, is a monitor. So this is the same generalization. So mutex only allows one process to enter a critical section. And this once this process is in, it cannot enter the critical section again. And the monitor generalizes this. It also is kind of a binary semaphore, but in addition, it allows
this is orthogonal,
this is addition. So it allows a single thread to enter several times. So it allows the thread to enter the critical section several times.
By the way, please
Yes. But that's just like a way they call it. This is older. They should have taken this. But then it's just a mute. It's the same data structure, and you set some attributes. Okay, now this vanishes. Okay, so all these, well, these two data structures I will refer to as locks. The semaphores are basically building blocks for locks, but you can do other stuff with semaphores. Okay, so what are locks? Yay. Okay. So a lock is a data structure, and it protects the critical section. So we have some sort of region, piece of code, or a piece of hardware or whatever. And this piece of, like these resources, accessing these resources will result, we have to access this resource concurrently from several threads. So this is called the critical section. And in principle, the critical section could be just a piece of hardware. So if we call if we say section, then obviously we mean a region of code. So the lock will ensure mutual exclusion. That means no two threads are in this critical section executing the same statements. And this always assumes that these statements access the same resources. A lock can block. So if one thread is in the critical section, that means it has the lock, then the other threads will block. This lock can be acquired and released. So if I want to enter the critical section, I acquire the lock, which means the lock is taken. And then if I am done with the critical section, then I release the lock. And what I'll also get is deadlocks. That means if I have at least two locks, we get to that later, and a circular wait. And so there's four conditions to a deadlock, and I'll talk about that later. So how can I implement semaphores with these building blocks of wait-free data structures? So here I have the general counting semaphore, which is simply an integer S with two algorithms. One is called signal, and one is called wait. So the signal operation means it's usually used when I'm saying I'm done with the critical section and releases the lock. So if S is 0, then the lock is taken, or the semaphore is taken. But if I implement a lock, then S0 means it's taken, and if S is greater, equal to 1, then the lock is not taken. Okay, so signal here then means that I'm releasing the lock, because if it's 0, then I'm adding 1 and I'm setting S to S plus 1. So this has to be atomic. I'm changing back to red. Now the wait operation needs to put a 1 into S if S is 0. And otherwise, well, it has to wait until S becomes 1. So we define a Boolean variable avail for available, and then repeatedly do until available is true, false. We wait until the lock is available, like that. So available is true if S is strictly greater than 0. So if the lock is not taken, then it's available. And if it's available, we increment S. So and then I have this atomic keyword around these two operations. So first I have to check whether S is greater than 0, and then if that is the case, I have to decrement this S atomically. And if I haven't managed, if available is false, I have to loop again until it becomes true. So a counting semaphore can track how many resources are available. And so one thread can say, oh, there's one more resource that's available. and then another thread, so by saying signal, and the other thread can say, I need one resource, give me one resource, and it says wait. And if there's no resource available, the wait will loop until it is available. That's one common way of using this semaphore. So a thread requiring a resource executes wait, and wait might just iterate for a long time. And if the resource is available, wait returns. If it's not available, it loops. And once the thread finishes with the resource, it calls signal, thereby giving this resource back to some sort of pool of resources. So choosing, say a resource is like stored in some data structure that represents like a set or something, then extracting a resource is a totally orthogonal thing and also requires synchronization. So I'm just talking about counting resources here and not about getting a resource out of a bag, say. The special case where I initialize the semaphore with one gives the binary semaphore. Well, if I never call signal twice in a row. So that means S is 0 or 1. And that I can use to simply block and unblock a thread. So if I have some sort of thread that I want to start and stop, then that thread will just call wait occasionally, and every time I want it to run, I'll say signal. Sorry. Or you can use it to protect a single resource by every time, so that you count the resources that are available, and if it's only one resource, you have exclusive access to the resource. Yes. So they're called signal and wait by the guy who invented it, Dijkstra, and there they're also called something Dutch, P and V. So I spare you that, so it's signal and wait. Okay, so if I use a semaphore to protect a single resource by using S, a binary value for S, then this data structure, lock and free and S, is called a mutex because it ensures mutual exclusion. Okay, so one problem with this implementation of the semaphore is that it busy waits. It will always iterate in wait until the resource is available. So one way to fix that is to insert this statement here after the basic block. So this is a conditional that checks if the semaphore is not available, which means not available is true, then I call a function called deschedule, which is a fictitious operating system function, so I made that up. But something like this exists in every operating system. And the idea is that by calling deschedule, this thread that runs wait is descheduled, put into the waiting queue, and it stays there for a while. Okay, so what do I do with threads in the queue? So a thread failing to decrease S calls this deschedule. Now this deschedule enters the operating system, and as this current thread, so which is now the waiting thread, into a queue of threads who all wait for a write to address of S. So this actually exists in Intel processors. It is possible to actually, so the processor has some internal thread infrastructure, and you can add the information that if somebody writes to a certain address, you want to be woken up. So if the processor actually goes to sleep. Yes. You mean here?
Yeah.
Well, available is a local variable. Nobody can touch my local variable.
No, but if the other thread leaves before it descheduled.
Oh, you mean if the other thread says signal here?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then available is still false. And the loop will iterate. Well, okay, I see what you mean. So it's false and you deschedule the thread and.
Yeah, and then you wait until forever. If it not, doesn't come back.
Yeah, but I consider that problem of the operating system. It is true, maybe it's incorrect. No, maybe it's incorrect.
It's actually, the thing that you need to have to do this correctly is that you need to be able to call descheduled from within the
atomic block.
While you're already holding the block, and then it's an atomic action to you fall asleep.
Wait, I'm not holding the lock.
Yeah, that's the problem. You have to be holding a lock, and then you have to call the schedule from while you're holding the lock. And then it is...
But if I'm holding the lock, I'm all done. I don't need to be descheduled.
No, there needs to be a lock that just protects the scheduling thing.
Maybe. So this is a bit abstract. I agree that somebody could do a signal in here and... the schedule would like put the thread to sleep, although S is not zero. So let's just like agree on saying that deschedule will deschedule the thread unless the content of S is actually zero, in which it will return immediately.
Ah.
So I'm fixing this on the sly, on the fly, as you notice. So, okay, let's say deschedule returns immediately if S is zero. Okay, in this case, if somebody has managed to decrement S, then this thread will not suspend. So I agree that maybe my interface is sub-ideal. I could perhaps pass a value that should be a return always, like and say like if S is this value, don't deschedule me.
No, I mean why don't you just put it into the?
Because I cannot implement this blob here, including the call, as a single atomic instruction on the processor. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to show how you can use the wait-free instructions inside the processor, wait-free building blocks to build more complex synchronization primitives such as wait and signal.
And you're sure that this DE schedule is implementable, again easily implementable, during the check? I mean, don't you just push the problem to DE schedule?
Well, DE schedule just deschedules the thread.
And check something for zero.
Okay, now it does. Before it didn't. Before it was simple.
No, I mean, the problem that may arise is that this complex thing that you like that you're trying to avoid here is that needs to be done in the schedule.
Well, no. Because once you're in the operating system. Okay, let's say deschedule just suspends the threads and occasionally wakes it up. Then all the problems are solved. But because like once you're in the operating system, you in principle you have all control about at least this thread whether it runs or not, and maybe the other threads that can access the same values. It is so if you look at the implementation of wait in the pthread library, it is like this. But that's also because I do a lot of optimizations. So okay, it's not that easy, but it is nearly as easy. So I apologize for the mistake. So, yes, okay, so I'll think about this. Maybe there's something simple so that I can fix it, but maybe imagining that a threat is occasionally woken up just by accident helps, then it should work eventually. Whew. Okay, I'll write that down. Okay, so deschedule enters the operating system and adds the waiting thread, so the current thread that is calling deschedule, into a queue of threads waiting for a write to memory address, the address where S lives. And once a thread, another thread, any thread, calls signal, well, not the waiting thread, it can't call signal, the first thread in this queue, which is T, that waits on the address of S is extracted. In this case, the operating system lets T return from its call to deschedule. So basically, it starts T again. Any more questions about this besides the brokenness? Okay. So then there are certain optimizations possible. The code is the same. Ignore that. So for instance, what's implemented in all the in the pthread library, for instance, wait will busy wait for a few iterations because often, like if you have some contention on a resource, then descheduling a thread and scheduling it has some overhead, and often it can be avoided if the resource is freed very frequently, because then the thread just idles a little bit before it calls deschedule. So this saves descheduling if the lock is released frequently, and you'll have in the end you'll have a better throughput, so more threads entering and leaving the critical section if this critical section is held only for a short time. And a different caveat is that the signal function, which corrects my brokenness, might have to inform the operating system that S has been written. In this case, the operating system can actually remember that S has been written, so that if somebody says deschedule on S, it will just like return immediately, so that in case the signal comes between in here, that a thread is not suspended, all because it's not suspended, although there has been a write already to S. So in practice, it's more complicated. But the point is, usually the more complicated the algorithm is, the slower it gets, especially if you have to call the operating system in the fall through path. So in the common case, using a semaphore with a single thread, so that means there's no common like there's only one thread using a semaphore, it is as cheap as testing S, which is here, if it's greater than zero, and then we decrement S, and then at the end of the critical section, we do a signal, and then we increment S again. And this is basically, well, the pthread library, if you use locks, it will be nearly as fast as executing this. I mean, it's not optimized away, and these are locked instructions, so they're quite expensive, but it's not entering the operating system at all, and that's important. So, and I don't know how I should do that if I do something special in signal. So in principle, we could say, so there's little penalty or no penalty in using a lock. So in principle, we could say, oh, why don't we then already decode with concurrency in mind? Well, the problem is that we can make all other sorts of bugs, and especially if we run our code with just one thread and it runs fine, then if we add a second thread, it might not run fine at all. So for instance, if we signal several times, then we just increment S. Like if we lack a wait but have a signal, then we slowly will increment S, and nothing bad will happen. But as soon as the second thread is there, we will see that mutual exclusion is violated. Okay, so here's an example which I want to make thread safe. This is a double-ended queue, and it has two operations: push left and pop right. So left is here, right is here, as it says. And the queue is implemented using two so-called sentinel nodes, which is the left sentinel and the right sentinel, and they don't contain any values. They're always there. So the empty linked, doubly linked list will look like this. It will have a pointer to the left sentinel and will have a pointer to a node that is the right sentinel, and they will point to each other. This is the empty, doubly linked list. Okay? So let's look at the operation. So the push left operations adds a new node in here. So I will use blue. So the first thing, the value is val, and the queue that's pointing in here, this is queue, is called queue. I allocate a new node. So let's draw that up here, and this is called qn. So the variable qn is pointing to this node. Then I'm setting the value of qn to val. Fair enough. Now I'm prepending the node qn to this doubly linked list. First of all, I want to get the first real node in the queue. So what I do... Oh, sorry. First, I'm getting access to the sentinel, the left sentinel. So here is a left field and a right field. And I'm accessing q left, which gives me this node here. This is the left sentinel, and then I'm accessing within the left sentinel, I'm accessing the pointer that points to the right, which is this pointer here. And this is old left node. So old left node points to this thing. Then QN, my new node, I'm setting the left pointer to the left sentinel. So this points here. And the right pointer, I'm letting point to the old node. And then the left sentinel point, the right pointer of the left sentinel, which is this thing, I let then point to QN, like this. And then the old left node, which is this one, the left pointer I let now point to QN. So there we go. So this now inserts the node into the doubly ended queue. So which part is the part that I need to protect if I want to have this push left operation run in parallel? Which statements? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I could obviously I can put the whole function, the whole procedure into a wait and signal, or lock and unlock. Can I do better?
The creation and the malloc of the node we want to insert can happen in parallel.
Yes. So I don't need to protect these because allocating and setting the value will happen on a node that's totally independent of the linked list data structure. So only this part here, at most, I need to protect, as in this has to be atomic. Can I make it better? So this is where the complexity of parallel programming comes into play. I would say no. I don't think you can make it better. So this is really the area where we need to protect. So let's do that. Let's protect it. So we're now using a mutex. So as I said earlier, or mentioned earlier, if we use the binary semaphore, we can create a mutex. So this is the very common usage of semaphores, is to guarantee mutual exclusion. In this case, this binary semaphore is called a mutex, which is bit wrong because mutex is a mutual exclusion, is a property and not a data structure, but it ensures mutual exclusion. So we ensure mutual exclusion by adding a lock to this doubly ended queue. So we need to decide what needs protection. We've just done that. And so here we have the two operations that can happen in parallel with all other threads. And then we insert a wait. So assuming that this queue not only has a left and right node, but also the semaphore, we use that to wait on the semaphore. And then at the end of this operation, we signal that we're done. So we have a wait, which potentially blocks us if some other thread is in the critical section. And then afterwards, we say signal, and we release the semaphore. Now, implementing the removal happens as follows. It's already in here, so we can quickly do the picture. So we have the left sentinel and the right sentinel, so only the right sentinel is interesting. So this is the right sentinel node, and this is Q. Now, we say we get the left sentinel by going to Q left, which is down here. And there's something in here. And we get the right sentinel by looking at Q right. Now we try to enter the critical section. So we can do this outside the critical. Well, I'll do that later. So the old right node, analogously to what we had before, is this node. So the old right node is this. I should now use blue. So the right sentinel left is the old right node. If the old right node, this one, is equal to the left sentinel, which means the queue is empty, we release the lock, so we signal it, Yeah, we have to signal, and then we return minus 1 indicating that we failed. Now, the new write node, which should be the node that's left to the old write node, so that's old write node left, this one. I'll make this blue. So this is the new write node. So the new write node is this one to the left. Then the write sentinel left should now point to the new write node. So we'll make this happen. Did I skip this? The new write node right should point to the write sentinel. And now the old write, then we can release the critical, the semaphore, because we're done. We have the old write node pointing to this element that we wanted to remove. And we get the value from this element. We free this old write node and return the value. Okay. Yes.
The last two lines before you enter the critical section where you left the sentinels. You leave them on the critical section?
These two?
The last two lines before you enter the critical section.
These?
Those two, yes.
Oh, yeah.
You can leave them out?
Yes, that's what.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's what I wanted to say. So basically, the sentinels are called sentinels because they always stay the same. They're never moved in memory. And because they stay the same, I can do this pointer access from the outside.
Now, but in the previous algorithm for insertion, you included them in the
critical. Did I?
So,
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think you can also put it up in our
critical. Yeah, so I could move this access out. Yes, I could do that, because it can't change. Good observation. All right. So as you can see, now we have two uses of signal, because we have an error case where the algorithm exits early and our control flow is not as easy to see, like the correctness is not as easy to see as if you just have a normal critical section. So in order to reduce the amount of errors we can make, we want to abstract this common concept where we take a lock on entry of a procedure and we release it on exit. And this is where we get to monitors. So a monitor is an automatic re-entrant mutex. So we get to the re-entrant in a second. So usually a data structure contains, well, like an object. You have some data and you have some functions on this data that modifies the data. So often these methods in terms of an object need exclusive access to the data upon entering the method, and then once they leave, they can release the exclusive. The invariant of the data structure is reestablished, and the lock can be released. So it's a very common pattern to lock upon entering of a function or method, and to release the lock upon exiting of the function. So doing this for a data structure is a recurrent pattern and should be generalized, and this is then a monitor. But the problem is sometimes you want recursive calls, especially with data structures, you want recursive calls, and then you find out that if you use a semaphore, you will block, because once you enter the critical section, the semaphore is taken, and then if you call yourself again, then you try to take the semaphore again, but it is taken already, and you block waiting for yourself, and then you're in a deadlock, which is bad. A third problem, which I will talk about in a second, is that if a thread T waits for a data structure to be filled, for instance, like remember the pop write, will have the case where the list is empty and then it will return. So in for instance, if you call pop write, you will get minus one indicating that the value that the list is empty. The only thing you can really do is you just call call pop write again until an element is empty. Basically, it's kind of busy waiting, even though you have things like semaphores where you could just like block. So you could use a counting semaphore to count the number of elements, but then each time you like insert and remove an element, you'd have to also call wait and signal on this counting semaphore. But it is an option. So if you do the busy waiting and don't count the elements in the queue using a counting semaphore, then you're kind of busy waiting. So as you can see, there are several possibilities to implement this algorithm efficiency. You can use a counting semaphore to count the number of elements, or you could just do busy waiting, and maybe that's faster. But then you busy wait, and that's usually not considered a good design because of energy and because other threads might do more sensible work than your thread. So a monitor is a mechanism to address all these three problems. So what a monitor is, it is associated to a procedure. So it's kind of a lock associated to procedure. And then each time this procedure is entered, a lock is acquired on entry and released on exit. And if this lock is already taken, we can proceed if it is taken by the current thread. So this is the extension what monitors can do beyond locks. Let's see. Well, it's on the next slide. So.
Because this kind of indicates that it is more powerful.
You can implement all. So all these algorithms are implemented using the weight-free data structures that I showed at the very beginning. So everything can be implemented using the weight-free data structures and deschedule. So yes, if you can then implement everything with locks because they're built upon the weight-free data structures and deschedule. The question is whether it's the right design in your program.
Whether there is an efficient. Is there an efficiency gain to implement this separately?
I can't answer that. I'll have to look at the next slide for that. So, the point is, if I do this. So if I allow a thread to take this own lock several times, like take the same lock several times if it's the same thread, then I need to kind of count. And I could use a counting semaphore for that, but I can join these two concepts and get it more efficient, I think. Let's see. So a monitor contains a mutex, just a semaphore, binary semaphore, and then it contains a counter. So this monitor now is a more complex data structure. It's not only an integer, it's an integer variable, as before, that we use wait and signal on, are kind of the same concepts, and a thread ID. And we initialize a monitor by setting everything to zero. So thread ID is zero and count is zero, and no thread can have ID zero. So if we enter the monitor, so we had a variable available, now it's called mine. The question is the monitor mine? While it's not mine, I'm trying to check whether the thread ID is equal to the current ID that's currently occupying the monitor. If it is mine, I'm just incrementing the counter. Otherwise, if the thread is not occupied, I set mine to true and I set the count to 1 because now I'm holding the thread and I'm setting the thread ID to my ID. Now, this is all atomic. And I don't care how I implement this. I could implement this with a lock or two locks. Basically, one binary semaphore for the monitor, enter and leave semantics, and one lock to access the data structure. Was there a question? No. Okay. I should probably finish. If it's not mine, I deschedule myself, and this is closing the while loop here. Upon monitor leave, I decrement the counter, and so I'm here. I need to could put in an assertion that MTID is equal to, just listen to my words, don't try to read my writing, thread ID. writing is not so easy on this thing. So I always need to make sure that I'm holding my own monitor when I see a monitor leave. It has to be me who holds the thread, but I'm assuming it's all correct. If the count is zero, that means I've held the monitor recursively several times. I call monitor enter, but now it's the last time that I'm releasing it, and now I should say that the monitor is not occupied by setting thread ID to zero, and now a new monitor can enter. Okay, and that should be it for today, because I can do the double-ended queue tomorrow. Basically, I put in monitor enter at the beginning, monitor leave at the end, and I'll just go through this example next week. Okay, thank you.